Okay. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, it's good to see the survivors here this morning. We put the coup de grace on this thing here in a few minutes. My specialty in AA has become the party killer, the guy that shuts it down. Because, well, I did that when I was drinking too, you know, so it was a fairly natural kind of thing. And I am delighted to be here. Did I say who I was? I don't think, I'm going to say it again. It sounds good. I'm Tom Ivester, an alcoholic, and a member of the Primary Purpose Group Southern Pines, North Carolina, and almost a native of Georgia, but it's good to be back. Good to see a lot of old friends. And to talk about the thing that I like to deal with, and you kind of previewed it a little bit yesterday, the thing of putting feet on the spiritual thing and the glow and all of that thing and putting it to good action. And, I'm a strong service person in every aspect. And so when I look at the 12 steps, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to other alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. And that's a bit of a challenging kind of a deal, but it's all well within the realm of reality. And rather than dissecting the step, what I'd like to do is talk about it in real life. You know, in terms of experience that I've had, in terms of how I go about engaging in that action of trying to carry this message to other people and the practices in my affairs. And so I'll go at it a little bit different. I've done it, I might have done something similar to the last one of these, but was that an amen? Sounded like it. I've been active in AA ever since I've been in AA. And when I first came to North Carolina, I was the youngest member in the state. Now I'm the oldest member in the state, but I'm still one of the most active members in the state. I've been blessed with not good health, but health that can be overridden. You know, so it's ugly when I move, but I get there, you know. So, and next time you see me, it'll be better because I'm going to have two knees taken off next month. And replaced, I hope, you know. The guy told me he had his knife ready. He didn't say anything about the glue to put it back. But anyway, we're gonna get rid of that. I'm somebody who really believes that the program is how we live, is what we do. And so I like to be involved in things that really are tangible and focused on trying to carry it out. You know, I'm a home group type of guy. When I say I'm a member of the Primary Purpose Group, I am. I am truly a member in every sense of the word. And mine, in every group I've been in, almost since I've been in AA, they're hard to find, but if you look, you can find them, are what we call three legacy groups. And the three legacy group, if anybody that may not be aware, is it, but certainly recovery is the foundation of the whole deal. Unity, how we function with each other and the world around us, and service, you know, how we carry forth this message, which is the only responsibility that we really are appointed. And so I've always looked for that kind of group. And in all honesty, it's been a pretty futile effort a lot of times. The Bob been misbehaving. I looked over, he looked like an alligator. He was yawning. It was fun, I believe. anyway, when most of you know, and I'm not going into the story, I might just sort of bounce off of it a little bit, but he's already been off. I started AA in a maximum custody penitentiary. Fortunately, I started it not owing to anything to do with the maximum custody penitentiary, but the fact that they had a good, strong three legacy group there. And man, am I ever grateful for that, because I got introduced into what Alcoholics Anonymous was about. And I was in there for 3.5 years and truly, truly found how AA works. In a situation like that, I became a free man, for the first time in my entire life. I found out freedom is not based on where you are. It's who you are and how you're dealing with her. And so I became a free man. I became a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So when I left the institution, my God, you talk about being overserved. I'll handle it, but if anybody needs any water, just come on up. I'll pour it on you. When I left that institution and went back to North Carolina, I knew that I was going to continue in AA. I didn't have any illusions. I knew I was alcoholic, and that was my problem. I'm not a criminal. I'm an alcoholic. And as alcoholics are wont to do, you know, I'm somebody that's just capable of doing a lot of goofy stuff. And I knew when I started looking at my leaving and what I wanted to do, one of my primary thing was I wanted to not go back in there again. The more you got to be a little better behaved than you were when you're speaking now. I noticed you came in with a twist, and so relax, you're next to Bob. And he's worn out from last night, so it's everything's safe. Anyway, if you can keep up with all that. When I knew I was coming out, I contacted I stole a world directory. And back then, we guarded those things fairly well, but they didn't guard that one well enough, and I got it. And I looked up AA in my town I was going to in North Carolina, and there were two groups listed, but one of them a little bigger than the other. So naturally, I wrote to the bigger one. I had a very simple letter. I said, I'm going to be coming back to North Carolina. I just want to know, is it okay if I come to your group? Because I wasn't sure about that. I mean, you know, corrections wasn't as it still isn't refined, but it was not refined then. It was still a very crude thing, and the idea of people being warmly welcome coming out of a Macbeth penitentiary was more illusion than fact. And so that was a very real letter. Just wrote the letter, didn't want anything, didn't want any clothes, money, or drive, or anything else. Just wanted to know, it's okay, I come in, and everybody's going to jump up and run. And did get an answer to the first one. I found out later that there was a man and woman who were really the leaders of that group. Their home caught fire, and they burned in their home. So no wonder I didn't get an answer. But I wrote again to the smaller group, got an answer this time faster than I could have imagined and better written than I could imagine. The guy that wrote the letter, he took the time. I didn't know. All I asked is it okay? And then he took the time to describe the group that he was in, to describe the interaction that was among other groups. Back then, we did a lot of those, what we called eating meetings, and we just gather up. I don't know what the topic seemed to be, where's the chicken or something, but he described all that, said, that was good to hear, and said, you'll be welcome in our group. We want you and need you. Well, God, that's almost like imagined poetry to hear something like that. But he was right now. I don't know about the wanting part, but they sure needed somebody. My first meeting I went to when I left was the worst meeting I'd ever attended. I mean, ever. If we'd had a meeting that bad in the joint, somebody would have got hurt. I mean, that pure sucked. So I went in that group, and I swear, God, I don't know what they were talking about, hunting dogs and shotguns and God knows what all. And I'm sitting there listening. This is what I've come home to, eh? And my first thought was, boogie, man, boogie, get out of here. I was 25 miles from the city, our biggest city, and I said, I'm going over there where there's some life and action. And then a disturbing thought occurred to me. I, at that time, was the oldest member in recovery in the state, except the guy who wrote me the letter, or in that town. And I was aware of that. And my thought was, when do you step up to the plate, big guy? And so the answer was pretty clear. He's now and here. And so I stayed there and had a wonderful experience. You seen my pretty coat? How about my pretty pants? Has anybody seen my pretty? Not these, the ones I'm not wearing. I've got to, somebody's got those things. And I'm gonna report you to God if you got them. But I hit that town, and I was not a brand new rookie there. I was a pretty seasoned veteran compared to most of them, and so I just went to work in that group. And the guy who'd written me that letter, in fact, became my second sponsor until he developed Alzheimer's and died. But he was the leader of that group. He was a real, real fine member of AA. And as happens to good members of AA, he got reinstated to an executive level position with an industry and moved away. Now, he didn't move because I came to town, I don't think. But there was timing that his job, he went to work there and became rich and famous, and I went to work where he left. And I had the experience of really developing Alcoholics Anonymous in a city and playing a significant part in that. And that was a tremendously important experience for me. And part of it, and I want to lead into 12-step with this, a part of it was the action. See, back in those days, unlike today, the 12-step call that you, and most people have heard of it, most people in AA today have not experienced it. I know that this is an above average crowd in terms of the development of AA. I mean, you spend money, you spend a weekend, you come out and you listen to wrestle with us and stuff like that. This is an above average crowd. But I would privately make a bet that more than half of this group, probably more than three quarters, have never experienced a 12-step call, either as a provider or a recipient. And that's true in most places in anywhere in the country today. But back in the days I'm talking about, you would have had a hard time finding anybody who was not the product of a 12-step call. And it's a part of our legacy that we've lost that I think is a huge loss. And I'll get a little bit more into that and visit a bit, because I think it is. And the overwhelming majority of people today in Alcoholics Anonymous can't visualize a 12-step call, much less share an experience. So it had some impact on our fellowship. You know, in those old 12-step call days, when you went out and called on an alcoholic, what that created was the most formidable bond you could possibly imagine. And when you walked into some rat hole like where they found me a lot, when you walk into that and reach out a hand and pull somebody out, there's a loyalty that's bred by that second to none. You would do the same thing for the next person without hesitation. Be absolutely no thought about it. It was just a natural instinct. There was a product of that we lost in the program when we stopped doing the 12-step call. A loss was this fierce loyalty that was born, you know, not just to the individual who came, but to develop the fellowship where he came in. And so the loyalty was a powerful, powerful thing. The loyalty between groups, you know, was a powerful thing. And a little later on, well, I'll just tell you a couple of things about it. I know that some have never experienced 12-step call. I had either till I went on my first one. And that was a learning experience. I got a call, and unlike Sonia, this was a girl who tried to sing, but she couldn't sing. She called me, and she taught me a couple of things. One was not to ask her to sing. The other was not to call on women by myself, because she not only was a singer, she was a lover, and a thwarted lover, too, I'll tell you. But that was, I got through it. It was pure. Both of us were pure. She didn't want to be, but I was, I guarantee you. Because I had been warned. My first sponsor told me that before I ever got back, got out, he told me one day, he said, "Now, Tom, I've got to prepare you for something. When you get out of here, that you're going to find women in AA. They're there. But I want you to remember one thing. When you meet women in AA, they're not women. They're alcoholics. Leave them alone." Well, I took that as gospel. And in 55 years, I got involved with one. And that before I ever got into the marriage business. And thank God we both came out of that alive, too. But anyway, it was a phenomenally important thing. And so when I started out, that lady was one of my first calls. And great teacher. She taught me something very important with that. And that 12-step call, which is almost an antique thing now, it's almost something we put in a museum, was such a powerful thing that it created that fierce loyalty that was there. And it was very revealing, too. I know the first time I had a call on a executive-level type guy, now, I didn't know the guy, but I knew the town, and I knew where the high-rent district was, and he was in the middle of it. So I went over there. Usually guys wanted a 12-step call from there. Either wanted to get out so they could get a drink or get away from her for a while or something. And he was both of those. And so I called on him, and I developed a pretty strong kind of principle about it. And back then, there was no detox. There was no treatment. They had things they called tapering off joints, and they worked. You know, we had one close to me for $75. I could take a guy over there in 3 days. He would walk out sober. They serve whiskey on the schedule. Now, if you don't think drunks can tell time, you tell them that the next drink's at 9 o'clock, at 8:50, be somebody, "Hey, see what time it is." But anyway, that was a part of that. $75 beat wrestling drunks, I'll tell you. And so I got this guy, and he was a nice man. And we fat mouthed till the middle of the night, and he wanted a drink. I wouldn't give him one. And then finally, you know, my barometer was that if I messed with him till 3 o'clock, it's done. I'll buy him a drink. And so I did. And I said, "Where's your favorite bootlegger?" Now, I thought I knew them all. I mean, I thought I was a patron of all of them. I said, "Where is it?" He named one I'd never heard of. And we went down there. I tell you, you have to guide me because I don't know. And so went in. It looked like an opium den in Calcutta. And the drunks scattered all over the place. I mean, laying on the floor, leaned up against the wall. And we went over to the counter. And my guy ordered something. I don't know what he ordered, but what he got had never seen any kind of a appropriate breeding place. It was awful. I wouldn't have drunk that stuff. I drunk brake fluid one time that looked better than that. And but this guy got it, bought it. And now just about the time he got the whiskey, I'm standing over backed up to the wall. Nice looking young fellow, looked like just a Harvard Law School graduate. So I'm backed up against the wall, and there was one policeman. They were dragging those drunks out, loading them up in cars. And I'm standing over against the wall, and one policeman couldn't stand it. He came over, and he said, "Mister, what are you doing here?" I said, "You wouldn't believe it." And he said, "Well, try me." So I told him what I was doing there. He said, "You're right. I don't believe it." But he believed it enough. He gave me the drunk. And illiterate stuff, he gave me that, and from then gave me hell. And one of the values of 12-step calls is that it generates an awful lot of connection. And so from that point on, I became the go-to guy. Anytime, I think to put my name on the post office wall, you know, it said, "For a bad time, call this guy." You've got But they'd say, if you got one you can't handle, don't know what to do with him, call this guy. He knows what to do. And I tell you what, I got in a 12-step called business. And it's just a part of the product of the 12-step call, you know, of how it creates the doors from whence alcoholics come to AA. And I didn't have in mind any strategy like that. I just had in mind how to get that drunk out. But the product of it was that we had cooperation with the professional community before I could spell it. And it was good, solid linkage that was there, lasted forever almost. And the same thing occurred when we started to, and I hope to God that you don't misread what I'm saying. I've never been in treatment, but I'm an advocate of it, because I guarantee you, if you've held enough alcoholics and watched them die, you'll appreciate treatment or anything anybody will do to help. Back those days, you couldn't get a drunk in any place. I mean, no place, except a little tape and all places. And we had one in my entire county. We had one physician who would, quote, treat an alcoholic. And if you had one that had the monkeys, you just didn't know what to do with him, you could take him to that doc's house, go around to the back door of the kitchen and knock on the door, and then he'd come to the kitchen, shoot him in the rump, give him a prescription. Loved that man. I paid a lot of $10 for those deals. That was the first semblance of anything. You couldn't call it treatment. You could then, because that's all it was. And thank God for it. You know, and so what happened as treatment started to emerge, you know, frankly, we did a lousy job of dealing with it. You know, sometimes we criticize treatment. I don't. I've never been in it. But I guarantee you I don't criticize it, and because I'm so grateful. If you've ever held an alcoholic in your arms and watched him die, you'll appreciate anything that gives a guy a shot. And so when treatment started to emerge, it had some effects. You know, one of the things that happened during that 12-step call era, there was a connectedness in AA, between, not just between members, but between groups. And there was a loyalty in that was truly valuable. You know, if a group was having a deal, everybody would go. We had those eating meetings where everybody just sort of congregate and get together. It was a real closeness in that. And you start a group, we'd go over and give them a boost and get them going in the group. It was just the way it worked. That was Alcoholics Anonymous working in concert with itself. And then as we started to drop away from 12-step call, we started to drop away from that. And if you look at the landscape today, you'll see anything but that. Now, yeah, after all the progress we've made, but that was a characteristic of it. When treatment came in, I was truly grateful for it. But it had a huge impact on our fellowship. When we finally had a solution, you know, I tell you, the first time I ever saw a sign that North Carolina was getting there, we're kind of a backward state. I was traveling somewhere up in the mountains and stopped by, and I was going to see some buddies in AA up there. And they said, Tom, you're going to be proud of us, man. I said, now what have you done? And the guy said, we have got a hospital where we can take alcoholics and they're treated like patients. I said, you kidding me, man? What are you talking about? They ain't nobody do that in the mountains. You guys are hard-headed. And he said, well, I'll show you. And what they did, and this is the way it had to be done, they had a hospital, and he was there. And you had to have, I don't know if they had a name for it or not, but you had to have an AA member to stand in the door and be available so nurses didn't have to wrestle with these clowns, you know. And stay on the post just like you're on guard duty. You stay there 8 hours. And the guy said, you want to take a shift? And I said, yeah, I'd love to. Man, I take it, never have had a chance to do it. And so I did. The guy said, I'm glad you're here. I've been here a long time. And he said, now, the alcoholic's okay. He's just fine. Haven't had any problem with him whatsoever. I said, well, that's good. I went in the room, and that guy left. No alcoholic. And I thought, where can the clown be? I mean, we were standing in the only door. It couldn't have been there. Was that somebody's pacemaker? Whatever. Anyway, maybe my head. But anyway, they went in the room. And there's nobody there. And I thought, well, God, now drunks, you are conniving, but I know it shocked you. But they went in. I looked in the bed, under the bed, drop bed ceiling. I pushed that up, looked, ain't no drunk. And so I'm standing there mystified. You're never surprised what a drunk does. But I was then. And I heard a little clatter. They had a wall locker type of thing over there. Heard a little clatter over there. I said, oh, yeah, okay. So I went over and opened the door, and he was only slightly confused. He thought he was in the bathroom at the urinal, and he only missed it one room. And and so I asked a brilliant question. I said, what are you doing? And he said, I beg your pardon. Excuse me, but I said, pardon my ass. Get out of there. But now that's how we did it in those good old days. But that, now I was so thankful to be able to put an alcoholic in a real bed with real bed clothes, real care. Excuse me. I would have done guard duty forever. But that was when the ball starts to come down. You know, if you fought that thing long enough, I guarantee you, you'll treasure it. You know, with no exception. And so, you know, that started to change the character of what we do in fellowship. And it was part of the demise of this 12-step call. And the demise of that sort of strong loyalty that's generated in that interaction. And you know, a lot of folks in the fellowship got jealous and angry about the emergence of treatment. Very critical, attacking kind of stuff. They're doing our work, and they're getting paid for what we do. For not, I heard that junk for the longest time. And it really was a tough kind of a marriage to pull off. And strange things started to happen. When a treatment facility opened in a community, you could bet that the number of AA meetings would double almost overnight. I mean, they're just like popcorn. They're just coming up everywhere. And they would tend to be one-dimensional meetings. You think about a three legacy meeting with Unity, Recovery, and Service. These became one legacy type meetings. And they became basically almost like aftercare for treatment. You know, that I've never been in aftercare, but I've sat in and helped conduct something. And it's basically just a matter of making that transition. And so that's what started happening. These meetings just started to proliferate. And AA population, meetings or people, would double. I mean, almost immediately, it doubled. And it was overwhelming, you know, trying to keep up with that thing. And so it did. It had that's why from that point forward, that's why I said with no fear of contradiction, that probably more than half, probably 75% of this group has never experienced a 12-step call. Because that part of our fellowship changed character. It changed to a different kind of thing. And I think really did some things that were challenging to us. The thing of us handling those things on our own and that just explosion of little meetings. They were basically convenience-type things. We still have them all over the country. They haven't gone away. We've still got that. Just about every city in America has them. And they're one-dimensional meetings. And they're essentially about me and my day, you know, about, you know, how's it going. And you start thinking about how you reach out to other people and how you activate and energize and this kind of thing. You've got an uphill battle, you know. And it tends not to be on the agenda. It's more the real, you know, me and my problem type of thing. And it has worth, I'm sure. But when you look at our overall mission in AA, it's not going to come out of that kind of breeding ground, eh? And so those kind of things happened, and the 12-step call started to just go away. And it really never has come back much, you know. You'll see pockets of it every once in a while. Learning to do that and having that sort of unity among groups, you know, that kind of thing just sort of shattered. And uh, So it became rare, and then we almost lost that sort of active outreach stuff that we were about. And so that's sort of the bedrock, you know, where this thing comes from. And now I'm somebody who wants action. You know, I'm going to have action if I have to start it. If it's dull, I'm going to wake it up somehow or other. And so the... I tell you what, when that kind of stuff fell away, 12-step, active stuff, let's tell you one other thing in case you happen to get into it some. I was in it all my life. I've had nine 12-step calls in one day. I had three last year. See what I'm talking about? It's a whole different world. And kind of losing that. I was sitting clubs really served a purpose other than just making me have good fun and neighborship and all that stuff. That was the headquarters of our 12-step work in Charlotte. And if anybody called, they'd call to the club number, and the guy at the club would say, "Hey, who wants to grab this 12-step call?" And it would happen. Yeah. There was one guy, I was over there one day, and I was a little concerned because I was still sort of a rookie, but there was a guy that was just absolutely par excellence as a 12-step guy. And I went over to him. I said, "Tell me, I want to pick your brain. Tell me, when you go out on a 12-step call, what do you want to leave with that guy when you finish?" And he said, "Well, let me think a minute." And he said, "There's three things. When I leave that 12-step call, I want that guy to know that he's alcoholic. Not me know it. I want that guy to know that he's alcoholic. Second, I want him to know that he wants to stop drinking forever. I want him to know it. And third, I want him to know that he can do that one day at a time." And he said, "If I can do that, that's a successful 12-step call." And he's 100% right. You need to go through the book. Then you need to get your head out of the jug, is what you need to do, and get into that survival mode of hanging on, you know, till the light comes on. And but it's a leg. It's a part of that thing when we start thinking about our 12-step work. You know, since those things no longer there now, treatment centers, we do stuff over there. We do it under the legacy of cooperation professional community. You know, like my group has commitments to two treatment centers, halfway house, jail, prison. Those are our legacies of carrying out the message. You know, having cooperation professional community, carrying out the message. I'll tell you one more thing about that and then illustrate a little bit. I went over one day to the hospital where we have a detox commitment. Somebody was tied up and asked me if I'd pinch hit, and I was loose. I said, "Yeah, sure." So I went over, went in, and walked up to the nurse's station. They were all just standing there chatting. And we all knew each other in a little town. You know it, folks. And he said, "Oh, Tom, yeah, good to see you. Glad you're here." And I said, where are the folks? She said, "You're not going to believe this. There's nobody in detox." I said, "You're right. I don't believe that at all. We're never without somebody in detox." She said, "They're not there." I said, "Where are they?" And she said, "I don't know. But they're just not here. We've got an empty detox ward." And a woman came down the hall, very, very, very sharp lady, a very distinguished looking lady. She was obviously a business type person and really carried it well. And so she came up. I didn't know her. She was the head of the, I think they call it the behavioral part of the hospital. I mean, anybody is acting like Moore was describing, she's got them. And so she came in and that also took in a detox deal. And so I didn't know her. We shook and howdied and all that. And I said, "Tell me why there are no alcoholics in the detox." And she said, "It's money." And I said, "What are you talking about? You know, we'd always been able to take anybody over there, whether they had money or not." She said, "Those days are gone, Tom. Those days are gone. And today, if somebody doesn't have money or insurance, we cannot admit them." And I said, "Isn't that something?" And she said, I said, "Well, what do you do with them if you can't admit them. She gave me very vivid stuff. She said, when they come in, they'll come into the emergency room, and then they got a name for it, not triangle, triage, I think, or something. Yes, somebody that sorts sheep from goats, I guess, is what they're doing. But they got that person, and so the alcoholic comes in, sees that person, and the question is not, where do you hurt? First question is, if you want to go to detox, think you have a problem, yeah. Do you have insurance? No. Do you have funds? No. Sorry, you can't come in. And she's telling me that. And I said, you got to be kidding me. Yeah, that you're going to turn an alcoholic loose who's coming here with critical need for care, and you're going to have to turn him loose? She said, I'm sorry, but it's true. And I said, man, that sucks. It's also a tremendous opportunity. And when I got over being mad and could think, I thought, geez, what a great opportunity for the good old days, eh? Rather than saying, I'm sorry, we can't help you, go away, and watch them wander off into the wilderness. What I put to our guys, our treatment committee, was let's give them a group of numbers that they can call and get help that doesn't cost anything. Jumped on it. What a deal, eh? It's bringing back the good old days. We weren't trying to. We were trying to help alcoholics who are going down the tube. But it's a way of reaching out. 12-step work doesn't mean sit home and think about it. It doesn't mean getting online and doing that kind of stuff. It means reaching out and touching the flesh with an alcoholic who's still in trouble. So that's exactly what that was. It's sad to have to do it that way, but that's the world that we're in, apparently. It certainly is in my community. We've had an active relationship with that place over 30 years. And so those things are there. There's still opportunities there. But I think we're going to have to forget this generation that we've gone through where we stopped doing outreach type stuff and find ways to do it again, just like that. That's simply... And, a lot of times, in fact, I think I told a group here in Georgia last time I was here, it just came to mind, that if you want to do something in your community, and nobody here is in a community that doesn't have a problem, I guarantee you that. You see a problem in your community, and you want to do something about it, what I suggested is kind of like I did. I stumbled into that. But when you get back to your community, take a look at where alcoholics hit the wall. And that's any place where they come to an abrupt halt. Can be jail. It's often ministers. My last 3 12-step calls came from ministers. That's where drunks go when they have no funds. And so, but the driver's license places, they're great places. Alcoholics tend to wind up there a lot. I had one I was working with, a real meathead. I tell you, I 12-stepped him 25 times, literally. And he asked me if I would go with him to present his case for restoration of driver's license. I said, now you better think that over long and hard. Because if I go with you, you may not like it, but I'm going to tell the truth. And he said, ooh. And I said, that's it. I mean, that's it. There's plenty of other people. You can get them. He said, no, I want you to go. And I said, all right, brace yourself. So I went in there, and that woman that was doing the quizzing, she learned who I was, She understood enough of that to understand what I was doing. She started asking me stuff. I thought a very silly question, but they were serious to her. She said, would you consider him an alcoholic? She's interviewing me. I said, if there's one on earth, he's it. And she said, would you consider him a periodic? I said, it depends on what you call a period. If you're talking 30 minutes, he's periodic. Yeah, sure. And on. I'd have hated to have me testifying for me. I tell you what. And I swear to God, it happened. This lady started defending him. I was so nasty with the thing. She said, he's not that bad. I said, well, he's not really that bad. He's worse. Well, I think that must have been reverse psychology or something, because she gave him his license. I almost protested as a citizen that, turn that fool loose. He got, and he, but anyway, I, the whole point is, when you're thinking about what we're talking about, the 12 step, how do you carry it out? You know, just hang around the club waiting for somebody to fall in the window. You know, you got to reach out. You got to find out where drunks hit the wall. And I'll guarantee you, there's not a community represented in this hall today that couldn't find that. So if you want to do it, there's no mystery to it. You don't have to reread the book. Just take a look at where to hit the wall. Just like I mentioned, my last three 12-step calls were from ministers. That's where they hit the wall. You know, and so, but anyway, that's where we are as a fellowship right now in terms of that kind of doing of 12-step work. Now, there are lots of ways to do it. Let me give you I talk so fast I don't know what time it is. Okay. Well, now, I'm not worried about y'all. I got a plane to catch. So that protects you. I'm going to have to just boogie sometime. But not yet. Let me tell you how I do it. Now, I'm about as busy in Alcoholics Anonymous and in life as anybody I know. I'm a busy dude. But if I ever get too busy to do what I believe in doing, I'm going to shut down some of my busy. But I'm a busy guy. I don't say no unless there is no alternative. And so if that's what I want to do. I mean, my God, man, I've been blessed more than any human I know. And I'm going to say no? Forget it. Forget it. So what I do, and I was talking with somebody about this weekend, to just sort of be in the frame of mind to reach out to other people, is I've got a regular routine, and some of y'all have heard me describe it. I wanted to put a pond in my backyard, and I love water. I love waterfalls. I mean, I could just sit by a waterfall all day, and it's just a rhythm to that. It's just in, excuse the expression, but intoxicating. It's just great to just sit there. And I wouldn't mind. Now, my wife, I told Mildred, one reason I didn't want to hook up with her is my wife is from the same province she's from. And water is an unknown commodity up there. That's desert. So I told her I wanted a pond. She said, that's insane. You don't need a pond. And she was adamant, you know. So I gave her a pond for her 43rd wedding anniversary. She said, good try, big guy. I said, you gonna love that pond. Yeah. I wouldn't let her feed the fish. I thought she'd go kill them. But anyway, you see, now I just love that. Yeah. And so what I do it right now. I did it this morning looking out that beautiful lake. And that's what I do. I go out and sit there, me and the dog, go out and sit by the pond. And I drink coffee or something. He won't drink any. But we go out and visit. And I do three things that work for me. It may not work for anybody else, but they work for me. Three things that help me suit up for the work I want to do as a human being, as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I do three things. One is I think about how absolutely unbelievably fortunate I am that I was given the keys to Alcoholics Anonymous and never even asked for help. I didn't know there was such a thing as Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was literally given an introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. No request, no nothing. And I'm grateful for that. You know, I was given a solution, at least the keys to the solution, of an illness that takes out the overwhelming majority of its victims. But probably close around 90% or something of alcoholics die of alcoholism, usually at the average age of 52. Never even knowing there's a solution. Never knowing. By the way, I'm going to throw in one other thing, no extra charge. The last time I was here, I tried to lay a challenge on the Georgia folks, but Georgia people got a lot on their mind. They may forget. They're talking about dealing with things that is wider than just where we're standing. I asked the crowd last year, and I'd ask you to help do this. There's huge problems with singleness of purpose. You know, we've got an awful lot of people, and AA becomes AA everything. And when it becomes everything, it's nothing. And so it's a little bit of a concern. It's no earth-shaking deal, but I asked some of the Georgia folks, since they're going to be the host and might be have a little influence, to have the conference set up a room, probably the size of this or something, but set up a room for an international forum on singleness of purpose. The United States is not the only place in the world that has singleness of purpose problems. Even Canada has a little bit of that, a whole bunch of that. I'd love to see us just get together. We won't fix anything, but I'd just love to see us get together and listen to each other describe what we have in our piece of the world. I think it'd be a really good, wouldn't be a group conscious, but it would be a group sharing of a dilemma we share. And I just think it would be a really worthwhile thing to do at an international convention, and good stuff can come out. I tell you, one reason I'm biased a little bit toward that is I got a call one day from a fellow up at the office, and he said, Tom, will you work with a guy from Kenya in Africa? I said, what do you mean work with him? I said, I'm not going to Kenya, I tell you that. I'm not going. Those people shoot all the time. I am not going over there. He said, no, you don't need to go. He said, you can communicate by email. I said, I don't speak Swahili. And he said, you don't need to. This guy speaks great English, better than you. And I said, all right, I'll do it. And so I set up a deal, and we worked together on putting together some stuff in Nairobi that had never existed. And all it is just two guys trying to communicate, cooperate, to get the message carried. And so took care of it. It's a strange world, and I am still not going over there. He asked me to, and I said, I'm not coming, buddy. Not coming. Yeah, y'all crazy. I had him on there one day, and I said, are you okay? They'd had another one of those uprisings. I said, you okay? And it was almost like just a casual comment. He said, yeah, I'm okay, Tom. And then he started hanging. He said, oh, wait a minute, I didn't tell you, my brother was killed in that last last uprising. And it was so commonplace, he didn't even, there's no drama, he just stated it as a fact of their life. So I think they'd be eager to jump into anything where they might collaborate with us and do something. So I hope that if you get a chance to influence that at all, put in a kick for it. I'd love to see it done. And so part of what I do is think about how fortunate I am to be in a piece of the world where there's a solution, and that it was given to me, literally given to me. Never sought it, never asked for it, was introduced to it, and thank God the miracle happened. And a new life began for this guy. And the overwhelming majority of alcoholics go exactly the opposite way. And so I'm deeply grateful for that, deeply grateful. And that's what I want to just think about. Nothing, not a lot of long, drawn-out stuff. I just want to sort of visit the fact of how fortunate that I am. And then the second thing I do is think about the gratitude. We talked about gratitude here some this weekend. Gratitude is great to talk about. It's a lot better to exhibit the gratitude. To show the gratitude. And so the second thing I do when I think about how grateful is that I want to look like a guy who's grateful. I don't want to go into an AA meeting with some morbid sort of drama and down in the mouth. Odds are there's going to be a lot of people in there in worse shape than me. And so I want to show the gratitude. Yeah, I don't want to tell everybody how grateful I am. I want to wear it. I want it to show. And let, good God, is that a no-brainer or what? And it's just amazing what that can do for an attitude, eh? You know, to have that gratitude. And it's just a wonderful process. And then the third thing I do is I ask my higher power to make me sensitive not show me what to do, to make me sensitive to opportunities to be of service. A whole lot different than show me where to go, show me what to do. No. No, make me sensitive. Because I guarantee you, in this room, we can walk through this room and see opportunities to be of service for people who are not doing too well. Charles did it. He helped us pull dude up the stairs there. That he'll tell everybody about it, so I might as well tell it. But that's just a simple thing. But it's a meaningful thing. It's a meaningful thing to the person who gets the help, and it's an extremely meaningful thing to the person who gives it. And so I try to make that a point of business with me everywhere I go. How are we doing, Dave? I got a plane to catch.
You're doing great.
All right, okay. Warn me.
Time to get out of here.
Time to catch. Charles, tell me. Charles is a world-class aviator. Well, he flew me home the last time I was down here. We're flying up there, and I looked away, and he wasn't holding the wheel. And I said, fly this thing, man. He said, you fly it. I'm tired. I've never flown a plane in my life. And he said, oh, go ahead. There's nothing to it. Well, there is something to it, I guarantee you. But we did a couple of those, and he said, it's all right. Anyway, that's what I got to do is go over and get on that plane. Okay. All right.
Started at 10:30.
All right. Good show. Good God. No, okay. I'm all right. I'm just wondering if these folks are. The opportunity to be of service that is absolutely is unstoppable. And I'll give you a couple examples. And I swear to God, I don't con and seduce people or stuff like that. I'm who I am. When I was working for a living, my office was right next door to one where the legislative people had their office there, and mine was over here. And I'm the guy, I either go out for lunch and pig out for 2 hours or don't go at all. There is no moderation for me. And so one day I just kind of have a little hunger, and they had a little snack bar. I'd never been there. You know, years, I'd never been there. I went over there, and I walked in the door, and there was a little old gal over on the serving line. And man, you didn't have to get close to know she had been beaten with the bat of life. And she was not a happy-looking girl. And she tried to smile one time. It's better if she didn't, because it was. Anyway, we went down, and I just woofed at her a little bit, you know, just trying to brighten up her day. You waving at me? Okay. Oh, okay. Well, you never know about women. So I walked in there, that girl, and so I just kind of messed with her a little bit, you know, just trying to lighten her up some. And she said, well, what would you like? And I said, I'd like a tuna sandwich. And she said, you got it. Well, I swear to God, I've had a lot of tuna sandwiches, but I never had one like that. I mean, that sucker looked like it was in a bit, I mean, just slathered tuna all over. I didn't like it that much, you know, but here I've got a tray full of tuna. And so I'm walking back through there. And I ate as much as I could, you know. And I didn't go back for a while, but probably 6 months later, I decided to go over and give it another run. And I really wanted a ham and cheese sandwich. And it didn't make any difference, so. But I got that door, walked in, and she started smiling with those three teeth. And I said, uh-oh, I'm going to eat a tuna sandwich. I could tell that now. And sure enough, I was there. And that other one was a piece of a tuna. That thing was unbelievable. I thought I'd get arrested for stealing it or something. But anyway, I didn't want that. I wanted a ham and cheese sandwich. But what are you going to do to somebody that's... And she's given all she had. And so I ate that stuff as much as I could. But you see what I'm talking about? Yeah, there's nothing. I didn't need a con or hustle or anything. I go by and treat somebody like a decent human. Act like they're somebody. Create some interest in them. Amazing little stuff like that, how important it can be. And I bet that girl looking for me right now. She said, God, I got more tuna. I don't know what to do with this stuff. But anyway, it just is like that. And God knows, I won't regale you with too many of them, but I've had unbelievable experiences of just that way. And I'll tell you just a couple. That I fly a lot, and I liked it till about 40 years ago, and then I quit liking it. Now I just put up with it. But the it's amazing what you meet on airplanes. I mean, you can sit there and just be antisocial if you want to, but if you just sort of pay attention to who you're with, it's amazing the kind of stuff that comes out. And I know, I think the first time I ever saw it vividly, I was on the way, I must have been crazy. I was going to Fargo, North Dakota in February. And that is not golf season in Fargo, North Dakota. And so I'm not happy about going, but I'm going. And so I got on the plane, and something broke on the plane. I had to get on another one. And I sat down. I love the middle seat. There was a little girl sitting there by the window, and so I went right, and I had the middle seat. And so I sat down with her, and so we started to visit. You know, who are you? Dumbest question. Everybody on the plane is going to Fargo, North Dakota. So I say, where are you going? She said, Fargo. I said, well, me too. Yeah, brilliant conversation going on there. Ask her, and I wasn't looking for a 12-step call, but I asked her, I said, you from Fargo? She said, no. She said, I'm from Boston, and I'm on the way to Fargo to apply for a job as a librarian. And she said, that's what I was doing in Boston, and that job's ended, and so I'm going to Fargo and interview for that job. I said, well, that's great. I hope it'll go out well for you. And she said, where are you going? I said, Fargo. And she said, what for? And I said, I have a conference going on out there. And at that time, I didn't say anything about it. And I'll usually drop a heavy enough hint and catch on. But then I let her be in her solitude a little for a few seconds anyway. And we were sitting there getting ready to go. And I looked out, and there was one of the wildest looking red-haired women I have ever seen in my life. You're coming down that aisle, and I mean really charging down that aisle. And I said, I bet she's mine. And and sure enough, here she came. She had the aisle on that thing and was just absolutely just bizarre. And so we went through the same ritual. You know, where are you going, Fargo? What for? And when she asked me, I told her, I said, I'm going to a conference. And she said, what kind? And I said, well, it's an AA conference. And she looked like I'd hit her with 220. She said, are you in recovery? I said, you better believe it, girl. And she said, me too. 7 years. And, well, obviously, the planes consisted of me and her. And we just sort of charged. I'd forgotten about the girl from Boston. So we're yakking away. She had a bad trip. Her husband had died of brain cancer, and she was going back to funeral in a grief period with her family, and it was a tough deal. And she was so thrilled to be sitting with somebody from AA at a time like that. And so we just got banging away. Oh, great, great. Michael, you're no wonder that preacher nabs you. Some things we ought not to ever tell, they don't go away. but we're banging along like that, and she said, are you in recovery? I said, yeah. And she told me 7 years and what she was doing. And then she got down to the deal. She said that she had that tragic thing going on. And so we just started to having a semi-closed meeting in that airplane, and everybody could hear us. We're not very shy people when we open up. And we had almost to Fargo. And I realized, I said, my God, I've been awfully rude to my original partner. So I turned around and apologized. I said, I'm very sorry that I said we got caught up in that stuff. She said, oh, no, mister, don't apologize. She said, you don't know how valuable that was for me to listen to you guys. I said, why? She was always the rest of the story, eh? She said, I didn't tell you the whole story. She said, I was a librarian in Boston. I was scheduled to get married last Saturday. Went to the church, and the groom never showed up. I don't know. I've never been a jilted bride, but that can't be nice. I mean, God, that's got to be humiliating in your community with all your people, and they're all there, and this idiot is gone. And I said, my gosh, that's too bad. And I said, I'm sorry, I got tied up talking to her. She said, please don't apologize. She said, after listening to you two, man, is there ever hope for me? And how grateful I was, eh? And we weren't just talking about junk. And this girl was eating every word of that. And so you never know. Your opportunities to be of service, they're everywhere. And if I'm clammed up and shut down, I'm going to miss a lot of opportunities to maybe be helpful to somebody, at a minimum. And at a very minimum, I'll get myself into the helping mode so that I'm ready to reach out and be helpful wherever I can. Now, I do that all the time. Most time it works. Just tell you a couple. I won't be able to get into the hard stuff. But it doesn't always work. I was loading up somewhere a while back, and there was a little woman. I mean, a little woman. She's a short dude. I mean, and she's trying to put, you know how they got the luggage up there that where you can't get anything in it. But anyway, they got a place up there you can reach up and put your bag in. Well, you can do that if you're 6 feet tall. But if you're about 5 feet one, you're not going to make it. So this little old woman standing there wrestling with that bag and trying to get it. So I went up there and I said, let me help you with that bag. She said, no. I said, what do you mean, no? Give me the bag. I just mugged her. I'd give me the bag. So I took the bag. I always got to pull her up with it, but she's hanging on. So I put it in. And she got through it, and she said, oh, God, I appreciate that. And I said, that's fine. I'd be happy to do it. She said, you're from the South, aren't you? And I said, well, yeah, but why do you ask that? And she said, well, I'm from New York. And we don't do what you did in New York. I said, yes, you do. My gosh, girl, open your eyes. The only difference is if somebody takes your bag in New York, they leave with it. You know what? That's why she had the death grip on that thing. Yeah. But just little things like that that come. And if I'm shut down and just locked into myself and my own little world, you know, miss opportunities. And my God, they pay off. If I got time for it, I'll slip in two more. And I swear to you, I don't try to heist people. You know, I don't really try to do anything to them. It won't sound like I'm talking fast, but it'd be fast as I can go. Too many bottles. Just a couple more. That's just how it works. You know, I was out in Oregon and got in real late at night. And I had to drive somewhere, so I rented a car. I told them just give me a Yugo or some thing. That I wanted cheap, so got up, went to the car place, and asked the girl how's it going. Just visited, you know, just said how's it going. You know, and she said, okay, we got your car ready, and we just chatted for about 3 minutes, maybe. And she said, after she gave me the pic, she said, would you be willing to drive a car for me that we're wanting to get a little test driving and feedback from? And I said, oh, God, people are always picking on me to do something. I said, what is it? She said, and she named some really luxury big car that had just started on production. Well, I knew that. I'm ordering a Yugo, and she said, would you be willing to take this luxury liner here? And I said, well, if it'll help you out, I'll do it. You know? But you see what I'm talking about? Now, I wouldn't try to con that girl. She'd been standing at that counter all day listening to yo-yos like me. And all I did, just a little kindness. Treat her like a human. And my God, I couldn't afford that car, you know, on 3 months' pay. I got that, but here I am driving off. She got the Yugo to drive home, I think. But stuff just happens. And I'll tell you one other. I don't want Al Anon to go untouched. I got on a plane and I was, I don't know how to say this delicately, but, well, she was a well-nourished female, I'll put it that way. And she occupied considerable space in that plane. And I'm sitting beside her. And I thought, oh, Jesus, I'm not even going to be able to breathe to all the way to where I'm going. And so I'm sitting there all scrooched up. She'll get through the same routine, where you going, and wherever I was going, and where you going, there. And I must have said something. She said, are you in recovery? I said, God, I hope so. And so she said, I used to be an Al-Anon. And I said, well, why'd you quit? And she said, well, I was married to a fool. And that every time I come home, he'd punch me out, you know, for something. For going to Al-Anon, he wouldn't let me go to Al-Anon. And she said, I got rid of that sucker. And now I know you're not going to believe this. A little later, married another one, just about like him. And he was doing the same thing. And so we had our little visit. And she said, I tell you what I'm going to do when I get off this plane. I'm going to Al-Anon. And if that sucker tries to stop me, I'm going to knock him out. I said, go, girl. Go. You can do it. She's big enough to do it, too. But see what I'm talking about? There's nothing really all that complicated about exercising just what it says. Your step says that we practice principles of our affairs. Carry the message to anybody, you know, to others, you know, to anybody. And if I'm not civil and concerned with my fellow man, just doing it in a closed meeting, it doesn't quite cut the mustard. Yeah, so it's something else. And last thing, it's a brief one, because I got to catch a plane. We were landing somewhere in Houston, I think, and I was sitting beside a young fella, and he, you talk about a clench, he had a death grip on those things there, whatever they are, things you hold. And so we landed, and I'm watching, and I try not to be conspicuous, but I couldn't help watching. He was white knuckle, and I mean he was gripping that sucker, I mean fierce. So I'm looking at him, trying, now do I be courteous or butt in? I said, I think I'll butt in. So I said, tough, ain't it? He said, my God, mister, you don't know how tough it is. He said, I fly every day of my life. That's my job. I either fly or I can't hold my job. I've got no choice. But every time we land or take off, I'm so terrified, I don't know what to do. And I said, a little bit of stretching of the truth is okay for spiritual purpose. And I said, you know, I had that problem. I didn't tell him it was for about 6 seconds, some of it. And I said, I had that problem. And you'd have thought, I said, I got a cure for cancer. He said, what is it? I said, well, I'm in a program, and we use a little prayer we call Serenity Prayer. And he said, do you know the prayer? I said, of course I know the prayer. I live by it. And he said, tell it to me. Every cell in the world got a pad in his pocket. Pull out that pad, and I gave that prayer to him. He missed a couple words. He said, say it again, will you? And we're landing. And but see what I'm talking about? There's a little risk of just butt into somebody's life, and that may be embarrassing. But it didn't embarrass him, I guarantee you, nor me. And that, to me, is the spirit of the 12th step. It's not a matter of just taking mine and being grateful and going home and stare at my navel. It's about engaging in this thing called life. And it's not just from us to each other. It's for us in the world we live in. And my God, what freedom that produces. And so anyway, great to be with you. See you next year. Take care. Thank you, folks. You take care of me. Next time we go to Ukraine, I'm going to tell you.